This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Is there anyone here? Raise your hand if I haven't told you about A, my buddy's brother who was carrying the deer rack on his backpack. I haven't told you about this? No. Okay. Raise your hand if I haven't told you about this man-eating tiger and this man-eating tiger in India. I told you guys all about it.
Yeah, we heard that one. Yeah.
Can you can we act like I didn't tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. My buddy's brother. He doesn't want me to say who it is, but it's a guy that's been on this podcast, and I've met his brother. I fished perch with his brother. Kills a Columbia blacktail in Washington State. And I haven't spoken with him directly about it, but he kills a blacktail in Washington State, and he affixes the rack, the skull and antlers, to his backpack. And this is one of those things that you hear about it being a no-no. Like, and we'll even tie orange flagging or tie a game vest or whatever around antlers when you're doing it. But you're always like, man, what are the chances that that would happen? That being, what are the chances that someone would mistake it for a live animal? Well, he got shot at. So it was such a close call that the guy shot a hole through his backpack.
Whoa, dude.
Wow. Too close.
The game warden hauled this dude off in handcuffs.
As he should.
Jeez.
Shot a hole through his backpack with a high-powered rifle, thinking, not only thinking that it was a live buck, but also that he was aiming at its lungs. Or he didn't get that far into the thinking. Horrifying.
What does anybody else have a story, like themselves or someone that they know closely, that's happened to? Like where someone shot at a sound or...
I know people that got shot in Pennsylvania turkey hunting.
Really?
I know there's three guys standing together talking after working a bird, and all three of them got hit.
What?
What did the person think he was shooting at?
Wow.
A turkey, I guess.
Mistook three mugs for a turkey.
Yep.
And knew it was a gobbler, not a hen. That's what
I don't know what he was thinking.
But that's what I don't get about.
I don't think there's a mistaking. There's movement. I'm going to shoot and figure it out later.
Is it that, or is it like buck fever sort of thing where you're just like so keyed in that like anytime you see like a rack or movement, you're like, oh, I got to shoot because that's what I'm out here for.
That's just too... In this case, you've got a rack that's pointed the wrong direction from what it's moving to if it's on a backpack walking away.
Buck of a lifetime, man. Inverted. It was an inverted buck.
It's just still blows my mind that stuff happens.
It's disgusting.
What are they thinking?
There's more lurid details about this individual, but I don't want to give them away. Not lurid details about the victim, but lurid details about the perpetrator.
He had some other things going on.
Mm-hmm.
What does the victim say?
I'm friends with the victim's brother.
Mm.
And I've fished with the victim. The near victim. No, the victim. I fished with the victim, but I'm not tight with him. Okay, the man-eating tiger. This is kind of amazing, man. If a bear, if a grizzly here scratches someone up, that's a dead bear quick. This tiger in India killed 13 people before they were able to kill the tiger. Whittled away at 13 people, and they finally... They got it to expose itself and lured it in using obsession cologne.
No.
13 people.
You're serious about
old,
this?
Yeah.
About the cologne?
Old obsession had like an extract, had some kind of like civet extract or something in it. And they find that it works really good as a tiger lure. Obsession.
Tell me you know more about this, and we can take this one step farther.
No, I was just reading about this.
I've heard that tigers have like a vengeance for people. They'll remember people's scent. They'll remember, like, they'll have it out, and they'll.
You guys speak up, Lauren.
Yeah, you guys got to get. You guys got
to
get tighter.
We're trying to share a mic, but we're doing the two finger thing.
But you sound like a dude yelling at a seminar.
All right, well, I'm going to get real uncomfortably close to Chris and tell you that I believe that what I've heard is that tigers hold vengeance against people.
I think that comes from one book called Tiger.
The Tiger?
Yeah.
By John Valente?
Yeah, who That's wrote one of book. The, really, you know what? You want to read a real book, read his book, The Golden Spruce.
I have not read
That's
that.
That's a writing some bitch right there, man.
He's good.
But there's certain books that come out. It's like Malcolm Gladwell writes a book. Then for the next 6 months, you got to have people tell you stuff that they tell you stuff that they read in there and act like that they didn't read it there. But you know what? Actually, the way to think about that is, and you learn later like where it's all coming from. But since that book came out, I've had 50 people tell me that about tigers. Not to take away from it because he's a hell of a writer.
What is his name again?
John Valente, I think.
Yeah, we've emailed.
V-A-I-L-L-A-N-T.
Dude, The Golden Spruce is about a giant golden spruce and the man who sawed it down and why he sawed it down. And he did not saw it down for the reasons you think he would have sawed it down. It's about an act of, like, eco-terrorism. It's a good-ass book. In Florida. Guy, you know about this?
Yeah. 17-foot python.
Dude just got a 120-pound, 17-foot, 5-inch-long python.
He paid for it, too, didn't he? Didn't it bite him several times?
When he was wrestling with it, bit him up a little bit.
Awesome.
I can't even wrap my head around a snake that big.
Me neither.
He can wrap his head around you.
God.
I can't wrap my head around why you would want to catch it. I'd catch it after I shot its head off.
There's bounties on him. I guess not alive. I don't know why he wanted to catch it alive. Just a lot cooler to roll in with a snake that's alive, 120-pound alive snake. It makes more of a statement, man.
Yeah.
To have a 125-pound, 120-pound alive snake. Just giant pythons, man.
17 feet long, man.
Kind of getting sick of those pythons.
Imagine the tree stands you were sitting in.
Dude, yeah.
It'd go from the top of that tree stand to the bottom.
That is insane. That's so scary.
And weigh as much as Ridge Pounder.
It just about.
What are they eating? Just anything.
Small mammals. They've eliminated a size class of mammals in the Everglades.
Jeez.
That's what our buddy Robert Abernathy, who worked on some python projects and whatnot. He's a biologist. A couple of interesting things he was telling us about is they've like eliminated like everything, like grinners, raccoons, like a whole size class of like mid-sized mammal. They just wipe them out. And he told me they're working on this stuff to try to test how far north pythons can go. And they can't penetrate the frost line.
Well, that's good.
So, like, if you live in, you know.
Yeah, man.
They're not going to be up in the Carolinas. They're not going to be up in Alabama.
Our squirrel populations and our cottontail populations would be in danger.
Yeah, there's no safe place to be a grinner anymore.
Does everybody,
we chased after a grinner last night, didn't we?
We did. We didn't come up with
it. He gave us a slip.
Does everybody know what a grinner is?
Is that a possum?
That's a possum. That's what Doug Duren calls them, grinners. Speaking of getting mauled up, now this is something we don't know. We just tried to fact check it, but it seems like there's something here that where we got in a mix up with a brown bear on a fog knack about a year ago, and I guess some guy just got mauled up pretty good. We've been hearing all kinds of rumors from one dude. One of these rumors, I don't know if it's true or not, is that he was sporting a Stone Glacier backpack and that his backpack got mauled. What do you think about that, Seth? You believe it? Because we tried to fact check it, didn't we?
Yeah. We tried.
What do you feel safe adding here?
He was a hiker.
Yeah, we don't know what that means.
We don't know if he's a scouting type hiker or an REI type hiker.
What if he was hiking around? What if he was hiking around hunting?
Yeah, that's what it said. I don't know.
Either way, we love them the same.
Yeah.
Ron Baim wrote in, all worked up about, you remember the other day we were talking about dogs and I was talking about the cake theory?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That got a lot of people. I've noticed today a lot of letters came in about the cake theory.
They're saying that that was a bad analogy?
One guy did. He was talking about when he smells shrimp scampi, that he smells all that. He said, I smell the butter and the shrimp, but it's just easier to say scampi. So I'm like, whatever.
Whoa. Okay. We'll let, give this guy a hall pass.
You got something to add?
Well, yeah, because, yeah, sure, shrimp scampi. If you can smell butter and shrimp, well, good on you. You don't have a broken nose.
Ron Bainbridge. We're talking about what does, like, what does a dog... But this isn't why Ron wrote in, though. Ron was right in conversation about the what hunting dog, like what dogs smell, like how is it different than what we smell. We got to think about like different climactic, not climax, climactic, climatic. What am I trying to say?
Climactic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Climate.
The event.
That different situations can influence a dog. And so Ron, who you might know from the Hunting Dog podcast, which is all about all things hunting dogs, he's been judging pointing dogs for the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association for 20 years. And he's hung out with a guy who's spent 20 years running dogs from Michigan to Montana to Arizona. And here's what these guys think. He says that For tracking ability on a dog, he says humidity levels are a major factor. He thinks when you get below 10% humidity, it becomes tough for a dog to detect game. And you get much higher than 60%, and it starts to have a negative effect. He says that wind speed is also a crippler. Anything over, say, 15 miles per hour, and the scent just gets too diluted and spread out too thin too quickly. He says you get winds in the 20 to 30 range, it becomes very hard for dogs to sort it out. He's talking about primarily bird dogs. It becomes very hard for them to sort it out. He says barometric pressure matters too, but it matters for a weird reason. If a front is coming in, birds just sit tight and they don't feed. So you don't have a lot of bird feet wandering all over the place leaving odor. So you could have this front coming in and think that somehow it's affecting your dog, his ability to smell birds. What's going on is birds just aren't out leaving scent. Most birds walk to their food source. When they're feeding, they're leaving smell. When they're leaving smell, your dog can find it. And he talks about when you're judging a dog or buying a dog, there's a scorecard category called use of nose. And he says this should not be confused with quality of nose. A dog has to have a desire to find game. He can't just like to just run around looking for it. You can have, he says, he says it's a lot like people needing to stay at the task at hand. He says, compare it to hunters that get tired or uncomfortable, say in the rain, and their desire to continue starts to slip a bit. They get distracted thinking about things like hoping the weather gets better instead of pushing through it and blocking out those thoughts. Dogs are very much the same way. The nose that is tied or matched to its level of desire will produce the best results. Some skills can be taught, but desire will always win the day. Just think about that. Ron Bain, Hunting Dog Podcast. Another dude real quick wrote in saying like, we get this a lot too. Saying like, hey, does copper ammo work? And the thing about it, go ahead, Yanni.
I didn't have anything to add. You just piqued my interest.
You perked up.
Perked up. I was just listening.
You perked up. Here's the way I would put it. I think that copper ammo is having a high rate of adoption because of efficacy. Like so many loaders use it. Giannis?
Agree.
Like serious shooters switching for no other reason than efficacy. I feel like the efficacy.
Accuracy.
Accurate. Yeah. Well, I'm rolling that in.
Okay.
I think for a while what happened with, in fact, check me on this, Giannis, because you follow this stuff perhaps tighter than I do. I think for a while when people first started using monolithic or copper bullets, it was they were using them because they were very accurate. But they had there was like early on performance issues because there's a lot to get right where the thing has to expand but not break apart. And I think it took some years to get it developed.
Yeah, it seemed like there was early critiques of when the bullets didn't hit bone, didn't hit some mass, that they would, the term was used, pencil through animals, like yeah. taking an arrow with a fuel tip and just pushing it through the lungs and not getting the upset and the damage that you're looking for out of a bullet. And I don't know if that was coincidence or if they did make better technology. I know that Federal, with their new, you know, trophy copper line, I know that they've made like a deeper cavity up front that's supposed to help, you know, initiate that expansion and make that those petals come out more, you know, so you can get the damage.
Yeah, people tried different tricks, like even like cutting them to try to get them to petal and break into four pieces. But I'm telling you, man, we've been shooting a bunch of the Federal Trophy Copper, and it comes out looking like if you had a magazine picture of like the perfectly expanded bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Like opens right up, turns into a nice slug. I mean, they advertise up to 99% weight retention. So like good penetration and it doesn't bust all up. And they put like a tip, there's like a cavity in there, but then it's got a polymer tip on it that helps it expand. And the other problem with it would be that, like, here's the thing to think about when you talk about this stuff, is when people talk about a long-range bullet, you might hear it and think like, oh, that means it's like accurate out to long range. It's probably true. Probably has like a high ballistic, or what's that word? Ballistic coefficiency?
That's right.
But the other thing when you talk about a long-range bullet would be that it will still mushroom. It will still expand at a low velocity. So if it's coming out of your muzzle at, let's say, 300 feet per second, if it were to hit something at that speed, if it's a poorly constructed bullet and it hits something at that speed, it might erupt into a bunch of pieces. But then it slows down and it loses half of its velocity and hits something, and it doesn't have, there's not enough force there to cause it to expand. So if you see a long-range bullet, what that'll mean is it can still expand. One of the things it means is it can still expand at low velocities. And I think that these are all things that have taken a while to get sorted out, which I feel like now they've just gotten it sorted out, where you have like solid copper stuff that has a polymer tip and a boat tail design and has, you know, a good downrange velocity, like it's still cooking and still opens up right. I just don't think you can really right now, I don't think there's really any, from an efficacy standpoint, I just really don't see there's any argument against it.
No, did this guy have a specific question about it?
He's just saying he's always hearing about it, but he hears different things about whether it works or not.
Mm.
This dude just wrote in today.
I've yet to have a bad experience with him.
I had a bad experience with a different kind a long time ago when it was still in its infancy. This is like 7 years ago. Not in its infancy, but I was using like an unproven manufacturer's offerings and had a penciling incident at a long range, 400 plus yards. Good? Mark Kenyon.
Yeah.
Tell me about sitting in the tree. Tell me what happens in your mind when you're sitting, when you're doing 12-hour sits. We're just finishing up a whitetail deer hunt, a whitetail deer bow hunt, peak rut. And Mark's been sitting all damn day.
Yeah, for the last 3 days at least. All day. 12-hour days. It's a long haul. I mean, me and Lauren were talking when we got out of the tree every day. You wouldn't think after just sitting for 12 hours that you'd be physically exhausted. But when you get out of there, I mean, you are worn down.
Well, you're in a saddle.
Today I was in the saddle. The 2 days before that I was in the stand. He was in the saddle every day. But yeah, I mean, you're looking a lot. You're searching a lot. But then there's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of periods of time where there's nothing going on. And the biggest thing for me on all day sits is it's of course partly physical, but I think the mental side is the bigger part of it. Being able to stay mentally engaged as much as you possibly can over the course of that whole day. And knowing that even though things have been dead for 2 hours, that at any time it could all change. So I've had my fair share of mistakes over the years where I lost focus in the middle of an all-day sit and it cost me. I told you guys a story last year about Holyfield, right? Mm-hmm. That was 11 o'clock in the afternoon and I lost focus and then there he is at 20 yards.
You were sending text messages.
I was reading a book on my phone.
Reading the book on your phone?
Yeah, you're sitting for 12 hours. You need a little something to kind of buy the time. And so I would like look at the phone for 20 seconds, scan all around me. Look at the phone for 20 seconds, scan all around.
Yeah, I got you. You reading haikus? What were you reading?
I was reading, it's a book called The Name of the Wind.
For a second I thought, I've never heard of a book called Haikus, Dear.
Oh, haikus? I'd read that book,
that
dude.
Would be a good
book. This book by High Country Coos, Dear.
I need to read that soon.
Is that Duncan Gilchrist offering?
No, Duncan Gilchrist's best book, his best book has an unfortunate title of Hunt High. And I think a lot of people read that. And they get to thinking one thing. But he's talking about hunting the high country.
Yep.
Not hunting high.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah.
Sitting all day, man. I think nothing of going out. Like, if we're, you know, regular old spot and stalk hunting, anything. I walk, you know, I leave knowing no way I'm coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I come back?
Yep.
Because I'll just take a big old nap out where I am.
Yep.
I'll eat my lunch where I am.
There you go.
But sitting in the damn tree.
It wears on you. The same scene for 12 hours, the same trail, the same trees, the same creek. It's all there. You don't get to do anything.
It definitely gets worse the tighter the space and the shorter, like.
Yeah.
If
you've got a view,
if you have, where you can glass every 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of toughing it out, having snacks, having water. And then, yes, I think that it is better to be in the tree and be slightly distracted on occasion by your phone or a book or something like that than not being in the tree at all.
Yeah, give me the main argument. Like, people can picture what it is, but tell me why you sit all damn day.
So the reason why you sit all day during the rut is because bucks specifically get up, some number of them, on a relatively consistent basis and are cruising for does from, let's say, 10 or 11 till 1 or 2 in the afternoon, especially older deer. Now, you're not going to see the same number of deer as you might in the typical early morning or late evening hours, right? Deer are crepuscular, so they're most active at first light and last light. So that no matter what, you're going to see the most activity then. But there's a disproportionate amount of activity, especially for mature bucks, middle of the day during the rut. So people,
you better tuck into crepuscular there a little bit.
Yeah. So crepuscular it describes an animal that's most active at that dawn or dusk time period. So deer, many mammals, right, are most active the first hour or two, last hour or two. But for this small time period, these bucks know where does will be in the middle of the day, right? They're bedded down. So they have a great opportunity at that time period to go from doe bedding area to doe bedding area to doe bedding area to find females that are ready to breed. So if you're willing to tough it out, it's a great time to get those bucks on their feet. And we saw it.
You think he's going around to bedding areas just to sniff all the does out and see who's...
That's exactly what they're doing.
I want to say who's ripe.
Yes.
That's not the right word.
Hot dough. Ripe doesn't sound quite...
Ripe sounds like something my wife would be like, really?
Yeah, it's a little bit too visceral.
I feel like she would say, because there's got to be another word for that.
Ready?
Hot dough.
Hot dough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And...
Because they're normally like the big bucks.
She's coming to her breeding cycle.
Exactly. There you go.
Is that clear? You guys knew that.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Because they're normally so paranoid.
yeah, this time of year they throw caution to the wind to a degree. You know, for love. I think we can all relate.
I think we definitely witnessed it several times. There was, you know, your closest call came at 11:30. Mm-hmm. You called it out before that. You said, this is my favorite hour, 11 o'clock. And here comes the one that was the closest right buck.
Yeah.
But there were several other opportunities during that time.
Yeah, two out of our last 3 days of doing the all-day sits, we saw potential shooters in the middle of the day, and lots of other bucks, younger bucks. And I've seen at least every year now for a good number of years, I've had at least one mature buck encounter midday. And the thing is, if you talk to guys who take this really seriously, I've got a buddy who always hunts all day, and he consistently kills mature bucks. And if you look at the number of mature bucks that he's killed, I think he's taken 17 or 18 or 19 of them during the middle of the day. You look at the number of hours compared to hours hunted across the board by other guys, right? There's many more hours spent in the tree evening or morning, but there's a significant percentage killed midday by the fewer people that are actually hunting that time period.
Yeah, like no one's there, but they're getting them.
But they're getting them. But it's tough. I mean, it's not necessarily fun.
Now, Lauren, when you're up filming Mark Kenyon being in a tree all day, what's your perception of what's going on? Are you like, dude, this job sucks? Or do you feel like you're hunting?
I think anytime you're out there, you're kind of feeling like you're hunting. You're part of the hunt. You know, it definitely isn't the greatest deal sitting in a tree stand all day, especially a sling or a saddle, or, you know, it's not comfortable. So, but you're definitely engaged looking for that one buck or any deer, any movement the whole time. So it's kind of just like an assist, you know. That's how I feel about it.
Are you periodically filming, or do you let hours go by and not film anything?
Well, I think that hours went by without filming, for sure. You know, you're stuck in one place. So shot options become pretty limited. You get as creative as you can, but, you know.
Yeah.
You're like, in retrospect, you're always like, oh, I should have done more. I should have done this or that. But, you know, you can only shoot the same angle, same depth, same focal length so many times. So you're, and two, we had a lot of opportunities on does and fawns and not moving and lots of getting pinned down. So there's only so much doe footage you're going to shoot. So only so much of the interaction. Oh, I got a close up of the fawn eating. You know, I think I've got 12 of those. So do I need any more? I'm going to stop filming that. I'm going to not move.
Does, you know, Mark ever yell at you? Like, what? How does Mark?
I think at one point we were discussing, did he say, what the are you doing? But then we reviewed the footage and he didn't say that. He said, what are you doing?
What was he doing?
What was I doing? I think I moved or something. No, you can't move like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Me and Ridge Pounder. Okay. Me and Ridge Pounder, we're like an old couple.
Yeah.
I'm like an old abusive husband. That, like,
he was pretty gentle. He didn't really yell at me, but I get it. I think it's definitely gets intense enough where you don't want to screw anything up, especially if you're on a, you know, a pretty high-end hunt where, you know, you're the camera guy. If you mess this guy's hunt up, you're going to hear about it, you know? And that's the last thing you want to do, is mess up somebody's hunt. So you're definitely part of the hunt. You're a hunter at that point because you're looking for the shot.
I felt bad a couple times. I think I apologized to you once. I was like, I'm sorry. I think I get a little bossy up in the tree. I have like hunting Tourette's where, like, I can't help myself. I have to say, don't move. Stop moving. Why are you moving? You can't move like that.
Yeah.
Like, a couple times. I'm like, oh, don't gosh, move. I sound don't like move. A jerk.
He's at your 6 o'clock. We had our system down for sure. And, and that happens real quick. The first day was brutal. The wind was blowing. It was 25 degrees. We were both shivering. You know, at one point your teeth are chattering. You're like, oh my God, are we ever going to be done with this? But then time goes on and a doe pins you down or whatever happens. I think we had, you know, we got lucky because there were a lot of deer
and a lot of stuff going on the whole time. So it kind of kept us busy in that mm-hmm. respect. And then after 3 days, the third day flew by. 12 hours was no big deal.
Yeah.
What time of the day when you're doing a 12-hour mega sit? God, it is 12 hours, too. It's almost maybe longer than 12 hours.
Well, we got in at
getting in the stand around 6:30.
Oh, 12 hours.
Get out just after 6.
At what time of the day do you hit where you're like, oh, we made it? 3?
Yeah. I mean, there's that point where 10 o'clock rolls around and you're like, oh God, it's a double shift.
Well, yeah. So it was the first day we did it, I think it was. We sat in that we went to this new spot and there was bucks chasing does all over the place. And it was like, it was a good morning. And it was probably around 10 o'clock. And I look at Lauren, I'm like, I've got good news and bad news for you. Which do you want? And then he guessed, he's like, is the bad news that we're sitting all day? Yep. We're sitting all day, but the good news is because there's a lot of activity.
Yeah, there was tons of deer. We counted yesterday. I think we saw 35. I lost count after 35 deer.
Yeah, at least 35 deer yesterday.
That keeps you busy, and there was enough to do up there. To, mm-hmm. Though it is totally uncomfortable. I mean, your feet go numb, and I don't know. It's not the greatest deal. But
this is my first time ever bow hunting for whitetails. Or any kind of deer. Bow hunting on like a private managed property where deer have a chance to grow old. And to like be there knowing that you could see one of these bucks come by that's 4 years old keeps you wanting to sit there. Because these are things you just read about, you know. Than to be like that they actually might show up. Mm-hmm. You think it's going to be easy, but it's not easy. It's still not easy.
Still not easy.
There's still too many things that could go wrong. But like knowing they're out there is makes it intriguing, man. Knowing they could roll around the corner.
How many opportunities did you have, Mark, on 2.5-year-olds?
We could have killed a lot of 2.5-year-olds. A good handful of them. Lots of year-and-a-half-olds. A couple 3-year-olds. 1 3-year-old, maybe 2 3-year-olds. I can't remember.
Dude, that's where you're screwed up, man. explain to people what you talk about when you talk about a mature buck. Because you always use the word mature buck. You don't put like a number to it.
Yeah, so I would typically call 4 or older mature. Some people will say 3 or older. In Michigan, a 3-year-old is a... if it's everything's relative, right? In Michigan, a 3-year-old in most places is... The most mature buck you might have around.
But you don't mean sexually mature because they're sexually mature at 1.5.
Correct.
So what is mature? Why not just say big ass bucks?
In the eye of the beholder, mature.
Right. It's in the eye of the beholder. It's all relative. But when you get to 4 or 5, 4+, you are at that top percentile of age in most populations in any state, really. I think people would look at year and a half old bucks being like your, I don't know, like a 10-year-old, like a young child, the way they act, the way they think, the way they operate. You get to a 2-year-old, you've got like a young teenage type deer. You know, you got your 15-year-old boy running around being crazy. You get to like a 3-year-old, that's like your college kid.
That's the dude out of the bar.
Yeah, he's like, they're hitting the bars, but they can be like the big boy in town in some places. Like they can walk around with their chest out. They're pretty good and strong, but they still don't quite have it. But when you reach 4, that's like your, I think a 4-year-old is like a 31-year-old. He's in the peak of everything.
How old are you, Mark?
31.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, 4, 5, 6. You're getting to they've achieved whatever body set structurally, skeletally mature. That's what I've missed.
That's a good point.
Yes, they're getting.
Man,
to that.
Do they have a weird way they look?
Different when they get that old for sure.
Everything about them. You see them from hundreds of yards away, and you know what you're looking at.
Definitely.
The way they carry their head.
The neck, the chest. it's almost a different animal.
And just how deliberate. They almost look like in their head they're going,
Yeah, they seem like grumpy old men.
Damn it.
Is what they seem like.
Walking all day.
How old are you, Steve?
44, man.
So I'd say a 4-year-old plus, kind of like a 44-year-old person. Yep. God damn it.
Yeah, halfway to 88, man. Uh-huh. But here's the deal. Let's say he snapped both of his antlers off. You wouldn't shoot him even though he's 4.5.
You know, I had an interesting scenario like that 2 years ago with... Not to bring up the same deer again every time I ever talk to you, but Holyfield broke off part of his main beam.
I like hearing about this deer.
Mm-hmm. And I thought him to be 4 years old that year, and he snapped off half his antler. And I was faced with this question. I was like, well, it's the buck I've been hunting forever.
He's mature.
At that point, I'd been 2 years. He's mature, but he lost half his antler. A lot of people were asking, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I said, I'm still going to shoot him. But if he had knocked off both of his antlers, in my thought, it would be, if I were to take that deer, I want to take that deer like as I knew him, if that makes sense at all.
Oh, so, come on. It makes sense, but come on.
Part of that, how do I describe it?
Mental masturbation?
You kill a deer and you take the meat, you consume the meat.
Yeah.
But then you also have some kind of memento to remember that animal by, hell to yes, see that man. Animal by. So that antler, his antlers, the mount, that would be an important part of that hunt for me to be able to look at that, remember that, see that. And it would just feel, it'd just be a bummer to kill him and not be able to see him in all of his glory again. And why, sure. I wouldn't want to kill something and then feel like a bummer about it afterwards.
Let me do this to you. Let's say you found it. Let's say you had him because you found where he snapped him off.
I guess in that case, then yeah.
Because you could peg them back on.
You could just, the taxidermist could fix it.
Oh.
But yeah, it's an interesting question.
Now, Holyfield was the, you think that buck's dead?
I think so. I found a shed in February, thinking, so I like, found his antler. So that means he made it into the winter. Figured he'd be back this year, but have gotten zero pictures, zero sightings. None of the neighbors that I talked to have seen him or gotten pictures. So,
what do you think he's? Where do you think he's dead from?
Well, I found his shed early, so I found it like the very beginning of February or late January. So it was an early drop. Lots of times, early antler drop is indicative of health issues, nutrition, something like that.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
So, my theory is that maybe he got shot by someone in gun season. He got injured in some way, so he had an injury. Dropped his antler early, and he succumbed to die off over the winter yeah. kill or something like that.
I was bear hunting one time in May and saw a bull elk still packing his antlers around.
Wow.
Is that pretty unusual, Giannis?
I've seen quite a few. Okay. I've had some of my best elk. I don't do a lot of it, but elk shed picking days late in May around my birthday.
Still dropping.
Well, just, you know, when you go there and they're all on top of the grass, nothing's growing over them, they're all just brown laying there, you know, like it just recently happened.
Yeah, I'm with you. to what degree, if you're a guy that wants to kill mature whitetail bucks, I mean, one, they got to be there.
Absolutely. In many places, that's the biggest thing keeping people from killing them, is that they're not there.
Yeah, they didn't exist when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up 90 miles from here.
Yeah.
They really did. I mean, I don't want to put too fine of a point on it. Okay. We hunted public land north of us a little bit, and we hunted some large farms. We hunted some large farms very near our house within an 8-mile. Well, all the hunting we did, unless we went out to Baldwin, so hunt public land. All the hunting we do is at an 8-mile radius, less than 8-mile radius of our house. Okay. And hunt some large farms. Two farms that my father knew from church, families my father knew from church that let us hunt out there, where these were like 300 and 400 acre dairy operations where they were running dairy and they were growing corn and raising alfalfa to feed cows. And they had river bottoms, thickets, like the whole picture. Okay. And these two farms were virtually up against one another. Until I moved to Montana, my old man's the one that shot it. He shot it with his bow. One time of all those years of everyone hunting and the farmers, kids hunting and us hunting and everyone hunting and the surrounding, only one time did a buck that I now recognize to have been a 3.5-year-old buck ever come off anywhere. I never laid eyes on one, dead or alive. I do not think they could reach 3.5 years of age.
Unless they lived in some deep, dark swamp hole that nobody went to ever.
The one my dad killed, he killed on the edge of a pine plantation. Small little thing called the pines.
What do you think, Mark? You think 20, 30 years ago, Michigan had any big bucks, or are they just not around?
I think that Steve's right to a degree. There were definitely fewer of them. There were mature bucks around, but they're few and far between. And then number two, I do also think that 20, 30 years ago, people weren't as tuned into how to kill mature bucks too.
Yep.
So it's much, people are much more savvy now in the things you need to be doing to see and kill mature bucks. Back then it was kind of head out in the woods, sit next to a tree trunk or something like that, or get up and sit on a tree branch and shoot something over a carrot pile.
Because you weren't running cameras either. Yep, so you didn't know. If you knew one was out there, then you'd like change everything to go get them. But you didn't know they were out there.
Yeah.
The one my old man killed, he didn't know it existed until it walked under the tree.
Right. Yeah. But I do think culture has changed so much that allows a lot more deer to reach that age. So probably the biggest thing is just that the number of mature bucks around is just higher now.
I remember being in high school and one of the farms we hunted on and one of the kids, Tim, who's still a big time hunter today and does a really good job. He's got a small property now, but does a very good job with wildlife habitat on this place. He was the first guy, and I was in high school, and I heard Tim Zerlot had passed on multiple bucks. And I remember thinking, like, something must be wrong with that dude's head. But he was a revolution. He was like a pioneer, man. He was a revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
It's like, passing on bucks, you crazy?
Yeah, it was unheard of.
And he had gotten good enough where he could do it. We used to think a big buck was just a year and a half old buck to put more tines on. My brother Danny shot with his bow one time. He shot an 8-point and got it stuffed. It's still hanging in my mom's house. It's a year and a half old buck. In our head, it was a giant. I remember he shot it and put a hole right through its heart. It took 3 steps and fell over right on itself. And he got it mounted. And you wouldn't believe what we went through to drag that deer out of a hole, because the last thing you'd ever do is cut a buck up in the woods because you want to go show everybody.
Yeah.
And it was like, Danny killed an 8-point. But there was no perception. It was just the same thing. It was just the same year and a half old buck. We thought that the points.
Yeah, exactly. On those points, I think that puts it in perspective. I think growing up, I was taught that like a spike or a forked horn was 1 year old. And then if he's a 6-point, he's probably 2 years old. And 8 points, 3.
Yes.
And a 10 is probably 4 years old. No matter the size, you know.
Gosh, in our family, we didn't even talk about age at all. It was just the points. It was like, oh, he's a spike. He's a 6-point. Never once did anyone say, oh, it's probably 3 or 5.
Oh,
it was the same.
It was just an 8-pointer.
My first buck was an 8-pointer, and I got it mounted, and I thought it was the biggest damn buck ever. But it's well under 100 inches.
Mm-hmm.
When I shot that thing, I was like in disbelief. I thought it was a giant.
Yeah.
Just because it had 8 points.
Someone getting an 8-pointer got everyone's attention, but now you look at him, you're like, yeah, it's just he's just a year and a half old.
Yeah.
So point being, I don't think that they were around, and then culture changed.
Yeah.
I think that a couple things that led to it in a handful of places, like information about what it required to grow a big bucks, and I think kind of a changing people. This is like some old man shit here, but. A lot's changed around the way people handle permissions and stuff on their properties. And I think that when I was coming into the world, there were a lot of properties around us, farms and stuff around us, where the farmer wasn't even exactly clear on who was hunting there. People just hunt. You know, if someone gave you permission years ago, you just kept going on it until they told you not to go anymore. Right. And so I think that there was more. I think that later when people started to recognize the value of deer more, they started to kind of like wanting to know who was out there. And it wasn't like such a free for all. You know, I would have hunting permission on farms where every person that asked had hunting permission.
Right.
No rhyme or reason to it. Like that kind of stuff has just come to an end.
It's tough to come by.
I was sitting next to the other night. I was sitting at dinner with you have met or heard of Shane Mahoney, everyone here,
mm-hmm.
to some yes. extent.
Yep.
So he's kind of a preeminent expert on the North American model of wildlife conservation. He's kind of a conservationist philosopher type figure. Is that how you describe him, Yanni?
Yeah. I like that.
He was talking about just the way it's become hard for new hunters, the way it's become hard for young hunters. Is those days are kind of done when you could just wander around hunting on people's land, on neighbors' land, and you know, the farms where everyone can just kind of go where you take your 22 and ride out on your bike and go. And he said there's all these programs now that are like meant to sort of like recreate that, but you're not going to recreate it. And if there's an upside to this, the upside of this is I think there's a lot more big bucks running around now as people like exercise more control over their stuff. And I don't know what good big bucks really are besides they look cool.
They represent something. They represent an ecosystem. Well, at least a species, a population that is in balance in a natural state. If you looked at the deer herd in Michigan in 1970 or something like that, or 1980s, whenever you guys were hunting around or whenever this was.
80s.
Okay. Yanni's giving 90s. Me a look like. that was a very askew deer herd. Heavy, heavy on the does. Very light on any type of mature bucks. Just tons and tons of year and a half old bucks. That's not a natural herd of deer as it would be in, you know, several hundred years ago when it wasn't as impacted by yeah. what we're doing. But now you are finding some places where you have a more natural herd, which is beneficial not just for hunters that like to see big bucks, but having a relatively balanced age structure, that's good for the whole herd.
What way is that good for the herd?
So for example, if you have more mature bucks and you have a balanced kind of structure of the different ages and things and the balance with the does, you're going to have a more tight rut. If you have a tight rut, if you have a well-timed rut that happens consistently in a small window, you're going to have a better fawn drop. You're going to have a tight fawn drop, a well-placed fawn drop that is conducive for the females and the fawns to be most healthy growing up the next year. So if you get, let me describe the opposite scenario. If you have a scenario where you've got lots and lots of does, not many mature bucks, just a bunch of year and a half old bucks, you're going to get does coming in to heat and bred at all different times of the year in the fall. So we're going to say a very spread out trickle rut. Does and getting bred in mid-October all the way to mid-December, scattered all around. So you've got fawns dropping in March. You got fawns dropping in, maybe not March. You got them dropping in late April, mid-May, early June. You want to have a tight drop. If you have fawns dropping all at the same time, less coyote predation. If you have them dropping at the right time that's not too early, that they're freezing and not having nutrition available, but not so late that they're getting a late start on being able to...
They go into winter small.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of different things along those lines.
Can I lay a couple things in here real quick?
Yeah, I'm rambling.
No, you're not rambling at all. But I remember... In that era, it was common to hear that you had buck to doe ratios of 20 or 30 does to every buck. And I remember when I learned that they're born basically 1-to-1 ratio, it was kind of shocking to see that level of harvest on the bucks. But there's a thing that, like, and I've talked about this before, I don't know if I talked about it here, but when we had largely kind of eliminated deer or really knocked deer back bad, you know, even coming up into the 1930s, 1940s, there just weren't that many deer around. People became very it became culturally taboo to shoot does. I remember, like, in this era we're talking about, when I was a kid, there were a lot of old timers that would, like, disparage someone who shot a doe. And because you wanted to get a deer, you just shot the bucks. And you shot every damn buck anyone ever laid eyes on got shot. And you'd wind up with these situations where you had, like I said, 20 to 30 does for every buck, and the bucks were all, most bucks were not living in to see their second December.
Even relatively recently, that was still the case in a lot of states. So, for example, in Michigan, and I'm going to get the numbers not quite right, but some number of years ago, maybe it was 10 years ago, give or take, the percentage of the buck harvest in Michigan, if I remember right, someone's going to email you and say I'm wrong, but it's somewhere in this ballpark.
Yeah, they will.
Something like 70% of all the bucks, maybe more, of all the bucks killed in Michigan were year and a half olds. Now it has dropped down to, so it's significantly improved, but it's still one of the highest in the country. Something like 55% or 50-some percent now, I think, is the number of the bucks killed in Michigan annually are year and a half old. And that's still like the top five in the country. But now across the entire country, several years ago, for the first time, an age class different than year and a half olds is a higher percentage of the buck harvest than year and a half old. So now, yeah. So now, bucks over three comprise over 30% of the harvest. If you look at across the country,
no way.
Mm-hmm. And this has changed over the last 15 to 20 years. It's been dropping down.
So why don't guys that are big into whitetail management, why don't they let? I know the answer to this, but I'm just posing it. Why don't, if you want balanced age structure, why don't they let the, once they hit four, why don't they become hands off? Why be like, oh, we want to make older bucks, we want to make older bucks, but then systematically kill off every buck that gets to be that same threshold age? Why is there not a movement to, or like a management strategy, be like, to be like post trophy and say like, oh yeah, man, if he hits four and a half, what, 1 in 100 bucks or whatever it is will be 4.5. So as big as they're going to get, then we let those go because we're going to create 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds. But instead, they get that big and people just get so lusty for them. They want them dead. So it makes it hard to argue that you're really trying to have these like age classes in place. It seems like you're just walking. What you're really trying to do is have big bucks because you want to shoot big bucks. And you're trying to like act like there's some biology or ecology or conservation at work when it's like, oh, how convenient.
I don't think anyone's going to argue the fact that anyone who is managing deer also wants to hunt deer. They want to take some deer.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, yeah, so there's going to, each person's going to set a different goal that is going to hopefully achieve something beneficial for the herd, but also they've got to have a goal as far as what they want to try to hunt and harvest. And if you start saying that, you know, I want to wait for 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 year old bucks, you're simply never going to shoot any bucks then, because it's really, really hard to get bucks over 4, let alone over 5, even on big managed properties. It's just not an easy thing to do, because even if you have a large property, these deer still go all over the place. So it's no guaranteed thing that if you pass on a 4-year-old, he's going to make to 5. Whether you're on a 100-acre property or a 1,000-acre property, that's not a guarantee.
So that just kind of winds up being about as old. Like, there's so fewer 5-year-olds and 4-year-olds even.
Yeah. I don't know of anyone, even the folks that take management to the highest level, have great big properties, that can control a lot of acreage. I don't know anyone that really looks at targeting anything over 5. 5 is kind of like that. If it's over 5, it is fully mature. It's kind of reached the pinnacle as far as body size, antler size. It's expressed whatever genetic potential there it is. What he's going to be is what he's going to be, and that's a fully mature deer that's going to do everything that a mature deer is going to do. And if you can get them older than that, great, but that's hard to ask for. So 5-year-olds are what most people kind of set as that top end.
During this week, tell me about the, or I can start, the encounters you had with the closest encounters you had with mature bucks and what went wrong.
Yeah. Well, I had one encounter with a mature buck, for sure mature buck. Do you want to tell my story or do you want to start with yours?
You go ahead. No, I'll do it. Whatever. You decide, Mark.
You should go first.
Okay. It began and ended so fast like they do.
Yeah.
So I'm perched up in a really shitty tree. Pounder, I don't think I'm going to talk about the one that you screwed up. Because I don't think he was 4.5. I think he was like 3.5 or something like that. What do you think he was, Mark?
So that's not the deer I saw. The deer I saw was the one that you screwed up.
The big one?
The other one.
That's a mature buck.
I didn't see the big, big one, but I'm talking about the other one.
No.
But did you screw that up?
No, I screwed up. Well, I, in that I'm a person that has an odor to him.
Oh,
not
yeah.
An unusual odor. In fact, my wife comments how I'm not a smell. In fact, not a smelly person. But okay, can we talk about the one you screwed up?
Sure, man.
It's a story that has to be told.
So,
first of all, I'd like to preface the story by saying that this has never, in the history of Meat Eater, ever happened to me before. As far as I know,
you're embarrassed about it, but you don't need.
Oh,
to be.
Terribly. So, Lauren was talking about the pressure of like being a camera dude on a hunt. Like that, to me, that interaction that happened is worse than anything either one of the hunters could have done.
Do you want me to not tell it?
No, you got to tell it now.
Okay. If killing a mature buck, Mark, what percentage harder does it become when you have a camera person?
It is harder.
I think it's half as likely.
Something significant, sure.
It's twice as hard.
A little less than twice.
Less than twice as hard. Yeah,
but still.
There's just a lot. There's already a lot that can go wrong, and you're just making it's not quantifiable because there's twice as much odor.
Twice, yeah.
There's twice as much movement. There's twice as many weird. There's twice as many weird blobs up in the tree. There's twice as much sound. And I found that the best camera guys, I don't know why this is, but the best camera guys don't have. This is not a fair statement. We have some phenomenal camera guys who don't have a strong hunting background, which is a plus, but they tend to not know how to read a critter.
Yeah.
They don't know how to read a critter, and they don't know when. Is this fair, Pounder?
No, it's totally fair. I think I've been learning
how to read a critter
a lot better.
Taking its temperature.
I can take a critter's temperature now. I feel maybe not to the extent of a pro, but I'm close, I think.
Like,
a lot better than I started.
When is it appropriate to move?
Yes.
Taking his temperature.
Yep.
A deer standing there who's kind of like waving his nose through the air and kind of almost wanting to like stomp his front hoof.
Don't move then.
You're taking his temperature and you're like, this is not an appropriate time for movement. Because this deer is like, I don't like something. I don't know what I don't like, but I don't like it. A deer that's got his nose up the arse of another deer.
Time to move, man.
Yeah, just
slowly.
Yeah. So you get it.
Yeah.
That's good, Chris.
A turkey who's got his fan up and his fan is between its head and you.
You can do it.
That's time to move.
Yep.
So we're sitting there and we're in a weird setup where we're actually in different things. I'm in a tree stand up in a shitty tree and Chris is in like a little outhouse. What do you call those?
That's like a box blind. Box.
Chris is up in a little miniature plastic bad box blind.
It was a less than desirable filming location.
But that wasn't the problem.
No.
The problem was about 10 a.m. I get a text from Chris, who I'm looking at. Chris can hear me. Because we're filming. So I have a mic and I can whisper to Chris. I can be like 6 o'clock, deer, whatever. But he can't communicate to me. We have one thing where there's a stick that he can hang out of his blind, and that conveys a certain message to me.
What did that convey?
That conveys, because this is a problem we have, conveys, I see a deer that you don't see. And I'll tell you that this stick does not come into play very often.
But it did one time.
But one time the stick came into play.
Oh, poor guy. You get a lot of heat, man.
I got a lot of heat, yeah. It's all right.
So your mom loves you, though.
It's 10 a.m. Yeah, we met Pounder's mom and Miss Pounder, Mrs. Pounder, and she was telling us what a great cook Pounder is. So, and she made a bunch of cookies. So around 10, I get a text. Is that what happened? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you needed to go down because you had left your camera battery at the base of the blind.
So I had my backpack, but then I had like a little go bag that I had made, and I was stoked on it because I was going to have it all like folded in and silent. And if I needed to like quickly change a battery, I would just reach into this bag, no zippers, no Velcro, nothing, grab the battery.
Still a noisy ass bag.
Yeah, well, until it's in its right zone, then it's not the greatest bag. But I was stoked on the idea, but then I stupidly forgot to put the battery in that bag and left it in my bag at the bottom of this ladder.
And you didn't have a pee bottle.
And I didn't have a pee bottle.
And you can't really snake her up out over the window ledge.
A little too high.
And you could have snaked her out the door, but you had to get a battery anyway. So he says, is it okay if I climb down? It's 10 a.m. Is it okay if I climb down and get me a battery and take a leak? I see the door open. I see him come down. I see him turn away from me. Presumably, yeah, you snaked her out. Yeah, and I look past you and down the hill. And I'm not kidding you, man. We've been sitting there all morning. And he hits the ground. Starts taking a whiz, and in the direction he's whizzing, I just like, here's a buck,
mm-hmm.
and he's coming.
And he's close.
He's coming.
It was like, you ever have a dream where like, you like when you wake up from the dream and you realize that it was a dream, you're like so relieved that it wasn't real life?
Yes.
That's what it was, except it was real life.
Oh,
that was like the worst case scenario.
And I'm saying to you, like I do, I'm like, Chris. Then I realize he can't hear. Mm-mm. He had to unhook. So you eventually turn around and I give you a frantic, like down on the ground. And I see him get out his phone. Like he's going to film with his phone and aim it.
It's my only instinct.
And it's a nice buck. It's a nice, like I'm like very interested in shooting this buck. And this buck comes up and I think he's going to come right up the edge you're on. And wind be perfect. And I'm like, he's going to pass him by 10 feet away. But it's like, he's probably not going to see because you're hunkered down in tall grass. But then he cuts and comes in and picks up your smell. And here's the difference between like an older buck and a not older buck. When he hits that smell, you watch deer hit smell all the time. And a lot of deer hit smell, they hit human odor, and they get this like, oh my gosh. And they wave their nose in the air, and they're like, they're going to run, maybe not. They stomp their foot. They take three bounds and stop again and whew, and blow and whatever they do. And then they drift off raising all kind of fanfare and tail in the air and whew, 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 all pissed off and letting everybody know and, you know. But it took them like a full minute to like come to the conclusion this is what they want to do. This buck hits that like that wall of scent. And he doesn't like his attitude doesn't change. Really. But he just stops, turns around, and lowers his profile. Like he seems to like slink into the earth more and just go back the same direction.
Mm.
Very often it's that you described that wall of scent. I feel like it's they hit a wall. They literally, you can physically see it as if they smash their head into it. And then bam, it's all different after that.
And he's like he doesn't desire to draw any attention to himself.
Yeah.
No pause. It's like, that's how they live. Like, that's the difference between a buck that dies and a buck that lives. It's like you bump a big mule deer buck. You know, like mule deer are famous for, like, well, you bump a mule deer buck and they run and they're going to vanish. They're going to get where he's not going to be able to. He's going to vanish over the edge, but he stops and looks back. Like the big ones, when you bust a group of them, he doesn't go the way the does go. He goes a different way and he never stops. He doesn't stop and do the, what was that? And this buck, man, it was kind of magical to watch him. Just be like, not killing me today, sons of bitches, and just slunk out. Now, the other one, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, this wasn't the short-tined one, or was the short-tined one?
He had one of his sides. One of his sides had noticeably shorter tines than the other side.
Okay.
Now, the one that was I don't want to say it was my fault, but the one that was not Chris's fault.
Yes.
All day we're watching deer that are like following a certain line of traffic. They're coming into our zone and they're like coming along the same edge and some break. Some go straight and some break left and come up past us, eat some dried leaves that are laying on top of the snow. They like that little spot.
Mm-hmm.
You just watch deer. They're like doing this all day long. And there's one spot I can't see really clearly. And it's kind of like a ridge line that comes up to where we are. And late in the morning, like you're saying, late in the morning, here comes one. And I look, and he's like already, it's happening too fast already. Coming against the flow of traffic, walking the ridge, just has that dead-on, like, paranoid look to him, but traveling, like, with a sense of purpose. And it's a 10. It's a nice 10. And he comes up. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, he's going to pass 10 yards away. He's going to pass 10 yards away. I get my bow. He's behind some brush. I don't even have a chance to start pulling back. And hits the wall of scent. And not even, I mean, he's so close to me.
Yeah.
And I'd been there for hours. And the wind's like, not the kind of wind that flushes everything away, but just the kind of wind that's like very steady in a direction. And you've pooled up, I don't know how much stink, at 10 yards away. And he hits it and just gone, vanished.
Was that one of the bigger whitetail bucks you've seen while bow hunting, at least?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Probably pretty nice one.
Super nice one. It was the kind of buck. And I was glad, I was kind of like, reviewing it in my mind, I was kind of glad I didn't have time to dwell on how nice he was. But I find that I could do everything better when I have time.
Yeah.
If I have time, you see something, you get excited. When you have time, the excitement goes down, and you start remembering the important things. This would have been one of those great shots to screw up because it would have happened too fast.
Do you think, is there anything, like if you, I always try to do this at least, any kind of mature buck encounter that doesn't end the way I want it to, try to self-analyze a little bit. When you look back on that, is there anything you would have done differently? Is there any other...
Yeah, I would be after all this time we've been spending in trees and just having things like that happen and then not work out. I think that it's hard to do it, but the balance of shooting lanes and cover.
Yeah.
Because here you have here I'm in a tree where 25% of the stuff around me, there's no possible way to take a shot.
You're also not that high in that tree either. It's a pretty low stand.
It's a horrible tree.
Yeah. That
from that angle, you got plenty of cover.
Yeah.
You can't, it's impossible to shoot. 25% of the, like 25% of your zone, you cannot shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Now though, if we assume that we're stuck with that stand where it is, if the back had been trimmed out, you know how much worse we would have been like hung out to dry then? That's the thing.
No, if you could, like I actually was sitting there tonight thinking about I was actually sitting there tonight thinking about this problem and the cover issue. And I think if I hunted a spot where I was really like putting in multiple years of hunting there, I would probably, like, my contribution to whitetail hunting would be that I would become very detail focused around selecting spots. Not just for their location, not just to take advantage of pinch points and travel routes, but I would put a lot of energy into places that had good cover and And so that if I looked around me, if I like spun in a 360-degree circle, I'd be going like cover, shooting lane, cover, shooting lane, cover, shooting lane. Even if I had to have someone come out, if I had to like take my woman out and give her a pole saw, give her a pole saw with a 30-foot handle.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't think you're bringing up anything new here. I think that you're explaining what most people go out there and try to achieve.
Not when you're doing, not when you're running around making snap decisions about stuff. Yeah, I think you do. When I was younger, my old man put a ton of focus on it. Not cover, but shooting lanes.
If you have the preset stands that you're putting up before season and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not like when you're doing the run and gun hanging hunt
exactly.
stuff.
And I think the issue here, right, both your situation and my situation, we ran into the same problem. But I think what we have here is we've got a property that we are trying to get stands up this summer, and a lot of stands up across a bunch of places, and there simply wasn't time to get every single one perfect, right, Guy?
And nobody hunted it.
Yeah.
You guys were the first ones
right.
to hunt.
So I think what we have this year now, we get this first run through of like all the stands we've hung, all the spots we got trimmed out. I think now this next spring and summer, we're going to know, okay, this one we got to fix A, B, and C. This one we got to trim out this, this, and this. And we'll have time to go back to a lot of these other stands that we just barely had time to get up this year. Now we can try to get things a little bit more fine-tuned.
You know, I have a background as an arborist.
Is that right?
So this is an especially sensitive subject for me.
I can feel that. You stewed on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've stewed on it as well because it hurt me too. But that's hunting.
Okay, talk about getting screwed by big bucks.
Getting screwed by big bucks?
Yeah. The anatomy of getting screwed by a big buck.
Well, that same day that you had your big giant buck come by and be stuck behind brush, I get this text message from you saying I had a giant at 10 yards, couldn't get a shot because of brush.
I told you I could have jumped on him.
Yeah. Yep.
I should have jumped on him.
Why wasn't that your change that you would have made? So that morning, like I said, me and Lauren had we'd been seeing a good number of bucks running through chasing does around. A lot of activity. So I gave him the good news, bad news speech, told him we're going to sit all day. And as you alluded to, around 11 o'clock, I turned to him and I said, hey, Lauren, this is the beginning of what I think is the best stretch of the day oftentimes for like that one solo mature buck to come through. Just notorious 11-1. Big bucks, big old mature bucks are going to come cruising through, checking these doe bedding areas. And the spot we were in was a really cool little bench on a ridge, and there's great bedding behind us, great bedding sort of in front of us a little ways, and then around the corner of this ridge. It just seemed like a spot that a mature buck would cruise midday. So we even set a bet. We're like, okay, I'm betting. Like, let's put money. I'm like, I have $1 bill in my wallet. I bet you that we will see a mature buck, a deer. I think we just said a deer. I bet like 11:35 we'd see the first deer between 11 and 1.
You walk around with a $1 bill in your wallet.
That's yeah. what he told me.
Yes. In this situation, I happened to have a $1 bill. And was it?
Okay.
I lost.
You did lose. And then later we double or nothing and I won again. But I wasn't quite right because we saw the doe at 11:30. The buck we saw 1 hour later. So 12:30 rolls around. We'd seen a few does coming through midday. 12:30, I am looking off to my right, kind of doing my scan, and I notice a dark shape moving along the side of this ridge. And there's snow over everything. It snowed overnight, so you could see these bodies real close. So right away, I pull up my binoculars, get eyes on him. And at first, I saw it was a buck. And I'm like, Lauren, buck coming at, you know, whatever, 6 o'clock or whatever it was. And he gets turned around, and I'm like, usually the first thing I say is if it's a buck or doe, and then right away there's usually a quick snap judgment, like little buck or shooter or something like that, just so he knows. Like if
shooter or not.
Yeah. And at first I was like, buck, big buck. And then I'm pausing, and I'm looking at him again, and I'm trying to look at his body and try to like see what's coming my way. And for the first time this trip, I was like, I think that's a shooter. I just remember noticing obviously bigger body. And then when you looked up at his antlers, I saw heaviness. There was a heaviness to it. And I remember looking at the main beam and seeing like something funky going on. another thing of indicative. Like, you're not going to see like a year and a half old or 2.5 year old buck. That's going to be some kind of unique funkiness to the rack. So he's coming down the ridge, and earlier, maybe 10 minutes before, does that sound about right? Maybe 5 minutes before, we had seen a couple deer running or moving across the opposite ridge. And so I'd grunted a couple times just on the off chance that one was a buck. We occasionally do like a Hail Mary grunt. So I grunted. Now this buck comes in. We didn't know if he was coming in just because he was cruising or if he was coming into the grunt. But
make your buck grunt noise.
Well, I usually use a grunt tube.
But yeah, but just without do, a grunt just tube. Without it.
Brock. 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 Brock.
It's more like this.
Brock.
Guy Zuck, you can probably do it. Do your turkey call with no turkey call. Check this out. This is guy with no turkey call in his mouth. Do the purr.
Yeah, that's where he makes his magic.
Yeah.
The magic is so purr. Good.
It's good, man.
Yeah, it's real good.
So there you are.
Nicest buck we got on camera, right?
Yeah, well you're stealing my thunder. Oh. So the next thing I know, he is coming up. He comes over the rise, and at this point, like, full blown, this is absolutely a buck I'm going to shoot. I grab my bow. I turn into position. He's working his way across. And at this point in an encounter with a mature buck, I'm usually holding my bow, and then I'm going to grab my release and have it clipped on and ready to go. So I go to clip on my release, and I don't have a release on my hand.
Because you were changing your clothes?
Because just a minute, like 10, 20, 30 minutes, something like before, I had added another layer, put a vest on. So I took everything off, put the vest on, and I'd take off my release. Well, I put my release in my pocket and forgot to put my release on.
Part of the downfall of a 12-hour sit.
Yeah, exactly. You're
going to want to put a layer on, take a layer off, whatever.
Yeah. So this is the most terrified I've probably ever been in my entire hunting life, when I've got this great big mature buck coming in and I don't have a release on. I said a bad word on camera. I'm like, I blinked up. I said that on, as he's walking in. I'm like scrambling, trying to get my release. I found it, and I'm trying to get it in my hand, and he's just slowly walking across. Fortunately, the area he's walking across is all limbs. Like, there's zero shot.
Couldn't have shot anyways.
Zero.
Could you have drawn back?
No, because he was so far from being able to be in a shot lane that I'd be holding back for 3 minutes. So I remember getting the release on, and my hands started to shake while I was trying to get it on so badly I could not get the strap through the buckle. Like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh my gosh, this buck's
going
to walk.
You still get shaky from bucks?
No. I was shaky from the release, from freaking out about trying to get the release
on.
All
that threw you off.
That's what threw me off.
Okay.
Like, I was like, I got to get this thing on, and I couldn't. And I'm just imagining he's standing right in the open, and I can't shoot him right now. He wasn't. But in my mind, I was thinking, as a, but finally, I remember telling myself, don't think about going fast. Just pull it through. So I like slowed it down, and I got the release on, and I look back up, and he's still behind all these tree limbs, slowly working his way. I'm like, okay. He's right there. He's moving in. He's like 30 yards. He's 25 yards.
Good question about the release. Do you ever practice fingers so that just in case your release had fallen into the snow?
No.
You would just have to let him walk. Couldn't shoot fingers.
I don't know how to do it. I don't think I would shoot fingers.
Can you shoot a short limb bow with fingers? There's no room for your fingers.
There's a minimum axle to axle that you have to have so you don't get like a real bad pinch from the bow string.
Yeah. My grip is so strong, I can just grab the loop.
Oh, yeah.
With a pinch between my index finger and thumb and pull back, man.
That's very impressive.
I do train that.
Wow.
Put it in your teeth.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
So no. No release, no go.
No release, no go. But in this case, I was able to get the release on time, and it was a huge relief. He's still there. I'm clipped on. I'm like, all right, this is great. But then I'm looking at him, and there's just no shoot. There's no holes I can get a shot. I can't thread it through anywhere. I'm looking at him, like trying to see, and he's just nooming his way along, kind of just sniffing around, walking along, just perfect. Now he's 20 yards broadside. Lauren's filming him great, and he's a beautiful buck. And then I look, okay, no shooting lanes. I'm seeing, okay, he's got to walk another 10 yards or so, and then there's
a gap. There's no reason for a buck to be lingering around that long without hitting a shooting lane. But he's moving anyway.
Yeah. And I agree, there should have been a shooting lane here. There just wasn't. There were shooting lanes in the other three directions. This was just the one spot that we didn't get yet.
But he's moving. So it wouldn't do you any good.
Slowly moving. And unfortunately, he slowly moved in the direction that our wind was blowing, the one direction we didn't want him to go. And there was no openings before he hit that wind. So just like you described, he's walking along and he hits the wall. And as soon as he hits the wall, it's like someone spanked him. Like he just jumped and bounced off. It's different than your buck that slank away. He hit it and like immediately jumped, ran off 10, 15 yards, stopped.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Looked back one time and then slunk away. And then after that, I just melted down. Because then I realized that was the big brow buck. The big brow buck was the buck that I got in camera in September or August, the biggest deer we'd seen on the farm. Really, really, really cool deer. He has he was the obviously most mature buck that we had seen yet. Huge body. Like I remember we got the picture. I'm like, that's a no-brainer.
That's the only real one we got that wasn't though.
Mm-hmm. And then he has this really unique, like at least 12-inch brow tine, just huge brow tine. So really, really, really cool buck. And he was the one I was like, man, if there's any deer I could happen to get a chance at, he was the one I would really like to get a chance at. And there he was at 20 yards, and I couldn't shoot him. And he bounces off, and that was it. So I was, you know, you have that these moments, especially in Michigan. An opportunity to mature buck is so, so, so rare. An opportunity to mature buck like that in Michigan is infinitely more rare. To have that right there in your hands after hours, so many hours. I mean, this is, you know, I've been going at it for quite a long time here in Michigan for, I don't know if that was like the 10th day in a row or something like that that I've been hunting in the rut. And to have it right there and not have it to come together is a little frustrating.
Even like it doesn't even need to be big, huge giants, man. Because I had like I loosed an arrow. I don't know. It was like a 8-point, you know, like a little, like a 2.5-year-old type 8-point buck. But this trip, like a screw up for me. And it's like all of a sudden, just there he is out of nowhere, no sound, nothing. Like there he is, and he's gonna be gone in no time. And I have a great shooting window, and he stopped, and I go to draw back, so I'm ready when he hits the shooting window. And if I need to, I'm going to say something to stop him, even though you said that with these bucks, don't do that.
We did have a phone call before last night. We talked about it, right? How they jumped the string.
Mark was saying they're so, like, they're too high strung and too nervous all the time. And when you stop them with a grunt, they tense up so bad that when they hear the string, they're going to bolt. They're going to jump the string. So you don't like to alert them.
If you don't have to.
Yeah. Well, I go to draw back and not go to. I draw back so that I'm ready for the lane when it's a nice big shooting lane. But he stops shy of the lane. And as I'm looking, I realize, oh, wow, there's actually like most of his rib cage is actually open. And I become so fixated on the fact that, like, what are the chances and can you do this? And, oh, my gosh, you can. And should you? And sure, it's open. And I'm, like, running this in my head. And as I'm, like, as my brain is sending the signal to hit the release, he steps. But I still, like, hit the release. And, like, reviewing in my head, I almost had the desire, like, reach back and grab my arrow.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, I didn't mean to do that. No. But he stepped and lunged, like stepped, or was already like stepping, like he's scared. He saw me pull back and like freaked and lifted up and stepped. And then his step, as I'm releasing the movement, his step turns into a leap and was gone for the arrow.
It's amazing how quick they can drop.
Dude, this is one of those old crazy ones.
Yeah.
This is the teenager.
So how did you feel after that missed opportunity? Like, how do you take that?
Well, at first personally, I felt pretty sick because I was afraid I hit it.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, one of the luxuries we have. We had two luxuries. One, a camera so you can review, and two, snow.
Yeah.
So I waited a while and got down and followed his tracks for a long ways. Not a drop of blood. And then I catch up to him chasing a doe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then went back. We watched the footage a ton times more, and it's not there. And I couldn't find the arrow because it went into snowy high grass. But like I said, I tracked him for over 100 yards.
How, based off the film, how much do you think he dropped?
He doesn't drop. He goes forward because he was already going forward.
But you don't think he went down, right?
Usually? I know exactly what you're talking about, but no, he doesn't seem to go down. He seems to go forward. He was already getting going. And I even, like, as my arrow's leaving, I'm saying, what do you...
Oh, well, Chris and I reviewed it, too. I would say for sure that he did the classic duck the string.
You felt he went down more than forward?
Yeah, because when they... Before they can go forward to make that action, they have to load their legs. And the what looks like a duck is when they load their legs. And they're lowering to basically get their legs into a compressed spring so they can then push off.
Okay. Rather than you guys sitting here having like knowing glances at each other when we're talking about this, he was already stepping forward.
No, he was. He was walking.
So
yeah, he was walking forward. As you released, when he heard your string, your bow go off, he did what's called ducking the string, where he crunches his legs underneath him, his body drops, and then he goes forward.
Okay. Where were we, Mark?
We were just talking about how we both had our opportunity to slip through our fingers like that, and how that can be frustrating.
Super frustrating, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I spun the camera over to Mark after that buck hit the wall and ran off.
Oh, yeah.
It was a cold day. It's 25 degrees, and he's shaking like a leaf.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you cold or what's going on?
I'm like, no, man, that buck tore me up. It was just...
He was shaking in his boots, like full of emotion, obviously. Big, big opportunity slipped through his fingers.
Did you cry?
Holy smokes.
I didn't cry, but I was shaken. I was upset and excited and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was it was the best buck on this property. And if we're talking, I've killed mature bucks in Michigan, but that for sure would have been the biggest buck I'd ever would have gotten a shot at in Michigan. So that's a really big deer for the state.
Yeah.
So that was an opportunity that I would have love to have seen it go a different way. So I was just, I don't know. It's something when it's so close for some reason and it just slips through your fingers, it hurts just a little bit more. Like, and I knew it too. In my head, I'm thinking that was my opportunity. Like, you're, there's a chance, but especially here in this state, you get maybe one opportunity to mature buck. Even if you hunt really smart on most places, at least most places I hunt, this is a abnormally good property for me. But most years, you've got that one chance. And if that one chance doesn't go the way that you want it to, you're kind of SOL. So I was like, that was it. And you were so, so close, 20 yards.
Two observations. One was ridge pounders, but it's interesting. Is that, you know, you're up here, and right now, because there's so much deer movement, you're having all these, like, adrenaline moments. Mm-hmm. And Ridge was noticing, and once he brought this up, I realized it's true. Adrenaline moments make it that you get cold.
On the come down?
Yeah. You feel your body temperature drop
mm-hmm.
in the minutes after adrenaline rushes.
Yeah. I could see that.
Which, if you'd asked me prior, without thinking about it, if you'd asked me, I'd be like, I'm guessing that it makes you feel hotter. Now, when it's real cold and you're camping and you got to go take a growler, my brother used to call it taking a heater because he'd always mysteriously come away feeling warmer. Like just the activity or something, mm-hmm. you know? He'd be like cold.
The relief.
And he'd go dig a hole and come back and be like, dude, I'm warmed up. Like, I don't know why. It doesn't make sense, but I got warmed up. But having a buck encounter or just a deer encounter, even just like something exciting happened, 5 minutes later, you realize you got cold.
Mm-hmm. I'd be shivering. I'd be fine before a big buck would come in close. And then as soon as he walks away, then I'd start shivering. I'm mm-hmm. like, wait, what? But nothing's changed.
Feel a chill. Mm-hmm. As the adrenaline goes away, it leaves you feeling a chill. My other observation is this, and this is harder to articulate. I spent a great many years lusting for and trying to figure out and crack the code on how to just like locate big mule deer. you know, and it took a long time to start. A lot of it was location, but also just strategy, like how to figure it out. For years, we just walk hunted, walked likely territory, thinking you'd kick them up. Like, this is like how we went about it. Just like you'd kick them up, right?
Yeah.
And over time, I learned like that not just that you need to sit and observe, like where you sit and observe and when you sit and observe and what you're actually looking for and all that. And then, you know, gradually like finding nicer ones. But the years of frustration around it made me want to learn it more and more and more. A weird thing, and I think it's because I have a long background of what we thought we were serious deer hunters, but we didn't do the stuff that you do, but we felt like we were serious deer hunters all from the time, you know, for a good decade I did that, between becoming old enough to legally hunt and then moving away from the Midwest. That's what we did and thought we were, you know, into it.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Like, I totally respect them, but I just don't, I'm not getting where I feel the lust for them.
Yeah.
No, and I don't know why.
Well, I think
they're so hard, but I just don't feel the lust.
See, I think you just haven't, this is too much of, you were dropped into a thing. You're just kind of along for the ride here right now. I think at least for me, what gives me this like insatiable craving to keep learning about these animals and hunt them and try to figure them out is the chess match element of it. The just the constant tinkering and rethinking and observing and adjusting and learning more. And that's something that in this situation, you know, you showed up to a new property, we're kind of saying, well, try this, try this, try this. I think that if you had to move back to Michigan for a year or something like that, and you had to dive in and figure all this stuff out, you'd start...
I'd get lusty.
I think you'd get lusty when you start digging into that, start putting that puzzle together for yourself. That's when things start getting really, really interesting. And this was an interesting scenario here because, you know, I'm learning it too, and you're learning it, and Guy, you're learning it into a degree, and this is kind of the first year this property is being hunted in this kind of way. So there's lots of new elements. We're kind of figuring things out as we go. I feel like we learned a lot just this week.
A lot.
All sorts of stuff I already know I want to do differently next time around. But all those mistakes that in the moment are like a painful mistake or something, that just reinvigorates and re-excites me for, well, I want to do this differently, and I want to do this differently, and I want to try that differently. And I think, and already, I mean, I was telling you guys the other night, like I'm sitting in my bed at night for a half hour to an hour looking at maps and thinking about, we should move the camera there. We should move a stand there. We should get it back in there. Because I think that these mature white-tailed deer, they don't live in the most rugged, rough country. They don't get the biggest antlers of any ungulate. They don't. They're not going to put as much meat in the freezer as a moose. They're not going to take you to a mountain peak like a mountain goat. But I don't think there is a more savvy, wary, tricky, smart critter out there than a mature whitetail buck. Like, they deal with a whole lot of humans, and these deer that make it to that age are just survivors. And to consistently get on them, and to learn them and be in a position to sometimes get a shot at a deer like that requires a lot of mind power, like thinking. And that just gets me.
I see it get you. I love it that it gets you. And I'm not like down on it. It's just like, it just, I don't know.
Did you have a good time?
Phenomenal time.
I feel really bad.
A lot of stuff. Why would the world you feel bad?
I feel really bad that like you just didn't that you didn't get a shot of one. I mean, you did get a shot of one.
Who cares?
But I just
I don't care about that at all.
Felt like I let you down.
No, who cares? I had a phenomenal time, a great time, and loved every second of it. But I don't like. Yeah, man, I'm just. I just like those mule deer and stuff like that. Just,
I get that.
You know,
I get that.
I love it. I would do it all the time, but. I think for me it's I think for me that I've that a thing that like some kind of strength that I have in hunting is just liking just go and go and go. And sometimes it's a hindrance, but sometimes it's a strength. It's like going, going, going. I like to sit and just watch and watch and watch and like be out. I think that I struggle a little bit with the stationary, the very stationary aspect.
Yeah.
Because even if you're sitting there glassing for mule deer, glassing for coos deer, whatever you're doing, and you're in one spot, there's like this kinetic energy that builds.
Yeah.
Because you know that all of a sudden there's going to be your chance and you're going to go.
Yep.
Even if you wait all day, you might wait all day, but there's still this idea that like go time. Now we're going to go.
Yep.
And to be strapped into that tree, watching things, and it would never work to go after them. They're just not going to put up with that. But watching things and feeling that it's going the wrong direction, and you're like, you don't have that autonomy, or you don't have that.
There's a lack of control. You can't make a move.
The agency. You don't have the agency to. And it like really, I don't know. I feel like I'd have to get better at it. You know, I'd have to get better at it. I used to not have the ability, like what I was talking about earlier, like trying to learn how to kill a mule deer. I didn't have the ability at the time. If you just said, "Oh, the key to killing mule deer is sitting and observing," I wouldn't have had it in me.
Yeah,
I developed it. I would have to develop the ability to sit in these damn trees.
I think,
but I wind up cursing the tree. I don't wind up loving the tree.
Yeah, I get that.
It's like I feel like I'm chained to it.
You know that if you had sat in that same tree that you sat when you had those two encounters described, you would have had another nice big buck in front of you this morning.
You know why he was there?
Because you weren't there.
Because I wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the funny thing, like hunting this stuff now, like you'd be like, oh, a big buck passed by that tree stand. Like, yeah, a big buck passed that tree stand because you're not in it.
Yeah.
It's not like he would have been, it's not like he would have been there anyway.
Yeah, it can be frustrating. Yeah, I do feel like the interesting thing about a Western style hunt is that a lot of the actual hunting is happening right then, right? The decisions you're making that are going to impact that hunt are happening right now. It's like, do I go up that ridge or that ridge? Or do we make the stalk now or do we wait? Many times the actions that dictate the success or failure of a whitetail hunt are not the actions taken right now as that deer is in front of you. It's the actions you took 2 months ago or 4 months ago when you made the decision to put a stand here. When you thought through all the things, all the assumptions you have about a deer, you think through all the behaviors that are going to happen on November 8th. All that stuff that's leading to what you're seeing on November 8th, the reason that happened is because of decisions made on August 1st and what limbs to cut, what limbs not to cut, which trails coming through here. Why did I want to access the tree stand from this way and exit that way? So much of the hunt actually takes place many, many, many weeks beforehand because the hunt really is in setting up the ambush location. We have the decisions we can make now in the moment are, do we hunt A or B or C or D, which place for what we have today, and then how you actually conduct yourself in the tree. But a big piece of the hunt you missed out on. So I would imagine that maybe that might change your experience a little bit too.
Yeah. A reason I like to hunt turkey so much is because it's so responsive,
mm-hmm.
physically responsive.
Yeah.
He does this, you do that. He does this. Micro movements, little, it's just like, I like it.
Yeah. Speaking of turkeys, we called in a lot of deer this week. They were very responsive.
We called in a bunch of deer tonight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did? Tonight too?
Called in a bunch of does.
Huh.
They didn't want to leave.
Why didn't you shoot a doe?
Yeah, I just didn't, man. We had a lot of opportunities to shoot at does.
Yeah.
A lot of them. I don't know why. It's a good question. I wondered the same thing. Just because we were kind of like hunting bucks.
Yeah.
And I'm not hurting for meat.
Yeah.
I'm sitting pretty good, actually. If I was meat crisis, it would have been a whole different situation.
Yeah, we would have solved that problem quick.
Yeah. All right, man.
Thanks for coming out and chasing whitetails.
I'll come do it again.
I hope it goes a little different.
I had a great time, man. I don't care if I got one. I honestly don't care.
Good.
If you could like probe into my brain and see if I'm telling the truth or not, I'd be telling the truth.
All right.
I really don't give a shit.
All right, good.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. It was fun to listen to you all week, learn a lot from you.
Well, and thank you to Guy and Matt for allowing us to hunt this location. And
sure want you guys to come back. It was a good time.
Do that turkey purr again. We heard that a whole bunch today, didn't we, Pounder?
Oh, yeah, we did, dude. We had
turkeys. We had turkeys up close, and that's the thing I remember, that you don't realize how much noise they make.
Yeah. A lot of messing around.
They're all making noise all the time when you get that close to them.
They're cool, man.
Getting in their winter flocks.
Yeah, we're 10, 20 feet from them. And
they didn't care about us either.
They're all making noise.
We were moving. I was, like, filming them moving. And they were like, don't care, bro. We're eating corn.
I think if you'd have said something to them, they would have moved.
Yeah. I was like, hey, Turks.
Well,
you guys need to get a turkey tag next year. Put in for one.
Oh, man. Today I was really regretting not having one. Yeah. Lauren, you got any final thoughts, man?
Just thanks for having me along. I learned a lot from Mark sitting in tree stands for 48 hours. It's a good time. I was definitely part of the hunt.
Yeah.
Not just here to take pictures.
Not just here chasing dollars.
he lost dollars, actually.
Yeah, I lost $2.
Oh, yeah. So
he still wants his $2.
That cut into the bottom line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. You know, obviously, sitting in a tree that long is not anyone's favorite thing. Maybe it's Mark's favorite thing. But
I admire it, man, sitting in a tree like that for that long. It's tough.
I think it comes with age too, the ability to, not necessarily the ability, but just the downright appreciation of it. It only comes with age of sitting there for a long time and just smelling the roses. It only comes with the long, you know, you're never going to meet a 25-year-old that's like, oh yeah,
I disagree.
You do?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I disagree too. Yeah.
All right, 18, whatever the cutoff date is. Cut off ages.
Yeah, there is an age.
I just think if you're tore up with it enough, you'll sit all day. If you love it enough, you'll do it. So there's like 16
right, but you'll sit all day, but will you enjoy it?
Oh, now that is different probably.
That's what I'm saying.
I think that even the 31-year-old me sometimes is like, God, why aren't they moving? Why isn't this happening? Like,
exactly. And I just think for me at 40 now, of it, just in the last few years, sort of been like, you know what? What else is actually better?
Yeah.
Than just sitting here and waiting for the next woodpecker to come by, or the next chickadee to come by, or whatever.
Yeah, it is a rare opportunity to just slow down and embrace.
Oh, it's non-existent.
Everything. Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in everything else.
My brother hunts by himself. He's a few years older than me, so I don't know what the age part. He hunts by himself. And he hunts by himself in the mountains, bow hunting for elk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that every day, it's part of his day to talk himself out of going home. Because he hates it. Hates it.
Interesting.
And has to every day talk himself out of quitting.
What is he hating?
The grind of it.
Yeah. I get that.
But he likes getting the elk so much. That in the end, it's worth it. But he says, every day I got to just be like, you can't, just don't let yourself, you can't go home. Don't give in. Don't let yourself go home.
I have moments like that every day doing these all day sits too. So much of hunting the rut in particular is mental. It's mental toughness. So every year leading to this point, I have like a little self pep talk. It is all about mentally being in it. Are you going to grind it out? Are you going to simply make the decision that no matter what goes wrong, no matter how tired you are every morning you wake up at 4 or 4:30, whatever, you're just like, geez, all I want to do is hit the snooze and keep sleeping. But are you going to dedicate yourself to say, no, I'm not going to give in to that? You're going to go out there. You're going to do what you know you need to do. You're going to tough it out. You're going to, you know, it's just every single year when I look at the rut, we kind of call it the whitetail world, it's kind of like the rut marathon, because there's like 2 to 3 weeks where everyone who really loves this stuff is using all their vacation time or whatever and sitting in the tree all day for 2 weeks straight or whatever. And that definitely wears on you mentally and physically. And And there's something to be said about coming out of that. And you can look back and it is, it's not like climbing a mountain physically. It's not that kind of physical challenge, but it's a mental challenge. And that I was telling Lauren today, like, as long as I come out of a hunt like this, knowing that I gave it everything I could, like I didn't leave anything on the field, or I left it all on the field. I'm not in any way feeling like
analogy.
a sport ball analogy for you, Steve. You don't cut any corners. If as long as I can know that in my head, I can drive home tonight or tomorrow morning and feel okay about this hunt.
I think that one of the things that gives people discipline in all aspects, this isn't just hunting advice, but one of the things that I'm starting to think gives people discipline is it comes as much from self-hatred and self-loathing as it does any kind of love for something in particular. Because what you oftentimes wind up getting driven by is hatred for the version of yourself that would quit. So it's not that you love the woodpeckers and chickadees so much. And you do, I'm sure. Everyone does. Or, you know, anyone that gets into this game does. But it winds up being that you are like, I recognize that the smart thing to do would be able to sit here all day or stay out overnight right now or like sit up on this hill and keep glassing or you name it. Take one more cast, right? Go over the next hill and do one more shot gobble. You're like, I recognize that that's the way to be successful at this thing that I care about. And I hate myself for wanting to do otherwise, other than what I recognize to be the best thing. And you're motivated by that as much as you are by the positive end of things.
Yeah.
I hear this from a lot of people. I have it. I know my brother has it. Yeah. Even like writing a book. You know? Like I hate the guy inside of me that wouldn't finish this.
Yeah. To Yanni's point earlier about how this might change with age, have you seen that change with age? Do you feel that way less than you used to, or is it still just as much?
It's only different now because I recognize it more. I used to just be like driven to do some things, but I didn't really think about it very much.
Right.
You know, like here's an example. When I was brought up, my mother still lives in the house I was brought up in, and my room was on the second floor of a house and it overlooked the lake, and there was these large oaks, still are large oaks in the backyard between my bedroom window and the lake. And I knew on mornings that we were supposed to wake up and go bow hunting early in the morning. I knew that if it was super rainy and super windy, we probably wouldn't go. And I would wake up and I would look out and would hope to see tons of rain and the limbs just going nuts, because it meant we didn't have to go. And how guilty I would feel for hoping to see that.
Yeah.
The guilt shit, man. The self-loathing and the guilt is a powerful, powerful force in life for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And quitting hunting or quitting fishing, that kind of stuff. The other day I took my daughter, my 5-year-old daughter, we were out duck hunting, and she's crying. She's laying in her waders on the bank of a pond, crying. And there was a real part of me that wanted to push against that very heavily. And I made her do that for quite a while. Because in the end, when she's my age, I think that's just going to do her a lot more.
Yeah.
That's going to do a lot more for her than anything else you could have done.
Right.
I don't want to sound sadistic, and it probably does.
No, I understand what you're getting at.
She's definitely going to love duck hunting.
You know what? I spent most of my childhood crying because my feet were cold, man. Not most of it, but not just, I don't want to exaggerate. I spent a lot of days crying because I was cold. To no one caring.
I know, no man. Caring. I wonder about that, too. I had those days, too, but I look back on it now, and I go, why did I become a hunter? Because I was yelled at for my nose running and sniffling my nose. and I was cold, and I was yelled at for this, that, and the other. And there was just something inside of me that just like no matter how much that was shitty, there was some other part, the chickadees and the woodpeckers, that I loved, and it kept me out there. But I feel like I've heard just as many stories now because I pay attention to it about raising kids in the outdoors, and the kids are like, fuck that.
Right.
I just got pushed and pushed and pushed, and it's like a fine line. I'm not really into hunting.
Mm-hmm. I think you got to weed them out. Those are the ones that got to be weeded out, maybe. Ridge, you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, I do. Well, it's more of a question. I had a bunch, and then I kind of got – that was a good little combo, man. I got kind of caught up in it. one of the questions that I had earlier was, like, do you think – and I don't know if mastery is the right word, but when you – Mark, when you were saying that, like, you got all these ideas about, like, what to do next on the next hunt, and you're, like, a really good whitetail hunter, do you – like, do you feel like you'll ever get to a point where you, like – are mastering this kind of hunting? And I like that can't, that's not like, you know, there's so many variables when it comes to animals that it's like, that's not really like a fair word, but do you think you'll get to the point where you just like have it, just like you'll know where something's going to be when? Or
I think that anyone who is really, really good at whitetail hunting will always believe that they have not yet mastered it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
because I think the
that's a good answer, dude.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're constantly learning. It is an always evolving, I keep saying chess match, but it is. There's so many new lessons learned I get every single year. I mean, certainly people achieve levels of consistent, quote-unquote, success that are on a different level than a lot of people. But there's always more. And that's the fun of it. That's why I think that we keep coming back to year in, year out. Never... it's never the same. I love that.
Yeah.
You had 19 more things you wanted to bring up?
No. No. Oh, the age thing about sitting in a tree. I would say that I did have a thought today or past couple days that if the pressure of filming and not screwing up a hunt because of the filming presence, like if I was just sitting in a tree for 12 hours, I think I'd be into it. Like I wouldn't be bummed or stressed.
You'd like it.
I'd like it.
How old are you?
29.
Will you take me up on the hunt invitation?
Which at your place?
Yeah.
Definitely, dude. Definitely.
All right.
I have a new freezer that I don't have anything that's empty.
All right.
I have a whole fridge that has nothing in it.
Okay. Then you got to make a trip up to Michigan.
I'll do it. Okay. I'll do it.
Let's do it.
Seth, have you said anything yet?
Yeah, early.
Oh, okay.
I shot my first buck at 12 o'clock noon, and I just remembered not wanting to be there, and I was 12 years old. But now...
what time did you... and you had been up there since daybreak?
Yeah, since it was an all-day sit.
So you were sitting till noon at 12 years of age?
Because my dad was like, you're sitting all day.
And now look at you now. You're a big time hunter.
And that was the very last day of the rifle season.
And you were a hunter, trapper.
Yep. I love sitting all day now. 27.
27.
Yep.
So you had a meeting.
It's a little tough to do like first week of the season. I don't sit all day.
Terribly effective.
Yeah.
So you came from school of hard knockers.
Yeah.
You like it?
Love it.
You're glad now?
I'm glad now. I'd do the same with my kids if I ever go that route.
That's what you wind up struggling with, man, because there was so much stuff that I hated about my dad. And the older I get, the more I'm like, man, I kind of see now where he was coming from.
Yeah.
I kind of see where he's coming from. And one of the biggest things he had is he was not interested in being friends with his kids. And I'd be just baffled by that. And now I'm like, I kind of see what you're getting at. I kind of see. Because he's dead anyway.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm going to die. Ain't going to do any good to be friends with me. Go be friends with your friends.
That's true. Yeah.
Mark, any concluders?
you know, I'm lacking any kind of terribly poignant concluder today, except for I'm really glad you guys got to come up here and do this with me. It was fun to get to share my passion with you guys a little bit, and, you know, teach you guys about scent control, which I appreciate the effort, but it was subpar still. I saw
you saw some major.
I saw some major infractions.
Yeah. Well, here's the, okay. Can we bring this up next time we talk?
Yeah.
Major infractions. Yeah. You pay for them.
Yeah.
And Mark has a lot of things he does, and Mark admits, I don't know what they all work, but if I do all of them and it makes a 10% chance, I'll just keep doing them all.
Yeah, it's a big enough. Yeah, exactly. That's enough to help.
I was skeptical at the beginning of the week. Now, after seeing all these deer hit that wall, I'm like, oh, I get it, dude.
Yeah.
Then so we had. Go ahead.
I was going to. Okay, so we had a number of different incidents where we got winded, even though I was doing a lot of things that I try to do. But it was definitely a compromised scent control regimen. Just it wasn't perfect. Given all the different things going on.
Twice as much smell.
I'm just a really smelly guy. I think that was it.
Lauren might be a smelly guy. Wears very loud jackets. no, but you're not going to get away with your scent all the time. But just last week, I had a 5.5-year buck go downwind of me and not hit a wall at all. So sometimes taking all of these precautions does help. Sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it does. But I'm willing to do it all the time to get those few times where it does.
Yeah. I'm all for it, dude.
Yeah.
Nothing you're doing, there's nothing you're doing about scent control that was like something I hadn't heard of. Or I mean, it's all like pretty much industry, not industry standard, but like you don't have weird like magical things you think.
I wish I did.
No, I mean, you have things that like are like very practical things. You don't have like, I find that if I, you know, eat celery 3 days before and then do a cleanse, you know, it's just good stuff. Yeah. Like, it's very similar to what fur trappers would do.
Yeah.
Fox trappers.
I was surprised, though, no scents of any sort that you're you saying use.
Like a cover scent or a.
Yeah, or yeah. Attractant scent.
No. It's illegal, though, now in Michigan to use any kind of natural. Urine-based scent or anything. So that's... I never used them before, but...
Really? You can't buy... What is it? Tink 69?
you can buy it, I think, still.
But you can't use that in Michigan. Walmart.
Can't use it because of chronic wasting disease.
Really?
Can I give my concluding thought?
Yes, please.
My concluding thought is if one wanted to go find all kinds of awesome... merchandise, Meat Eater podcast stuff, soon to be Wired to Hunt merchandise, all kinds of t-shirts, your Blout shirt. We got some amazing other new stuff coming out. And then and if you've been watching the new episodes of the show on Netflix and you see like cool shit there, First Light Apparel, we have all this stuff for sale. Go to themeateater.com and go into the store and check it out. That's my first concluder. Second concluder was I thought that was pretty good deep fried turkey.
Mm-hmm. Very good deep fried turkey.
Deep fried turkey nuggets. Where's that turkey from?
Matt's freezer.
You just found a wild turkey in there?
Two breasts.
Two lobes.
God, I like that, man. Two lobes. Deep fried turkey chunks.
Hard to beat.
It's guy's birthday.
A little sweet chili sauce.
Happy birthday, guy.
Happy birthday, guy.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed that birthday.
Yeah. How old are you?
Dinner?
175.
That's why you can make that turkey call.
So how old are you?
49.
Huh.
Happy birthday,
halfway
guy.
Halfway to 96.
Halfway.
That's a rough way to position it.
Oldest guy in the room.
That's it.
Do still that turkey purr again.
Still got my hair.
Just hit me one more turkey purr. I love that shit, man. Yanni?
Thanks for asking. Thought you'd never get to me. Big room of people. I was thinking if you wanted to become a better whitetail deer hunter, you should go check out Wired to Hunt. Because anything and everything you ever want to know about whitetails and more, it's all there.
That's what I wanted to bring. I meant to bring that up. I'm glad he brought that up because Mark talks about this shit all the time.
Yes. And all that stuff now is actually on the MeatEater.com website, though, Yanni.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to the MeatEater.com and you're going to see all my new content.
But the Wired to Hunt podcast is available anywhere you find podcasts.
The Wired to Hunt podcast is available anywhere you find podcasts. My video series is on the website and on our YouTube channel. Regular blog posts. And the Wired to Hunt merchandise is not soon to be available on the store. It is actually on the store as of right now.
Oh, it is?
It is.
Oh.
So you got Wired to Hunt hats, Wired to Hunt t-shirts, and there'll be some new things coming down the road.
How come I don't have one of those? It's weird that you've never given me one.
I didn't. Well, I don't know.
I feel like you should present one to me.
what the hell, Mark?
On Wired to Hunt podcast, what would you say, like, what percent of the time are you guys talking about, like, whitetail stuff?
Oh, 97%.
97%.
Yeah. What's the other three?
Yeah, like, one episode a year, I'll go on an elk hunt or something. One episode a year, we'll talk turkeys.
No marital advice?
Well, there's little bits of marital advice and family advice sprinkled within each episode, usually.
Give me a piece of marital advice.
Oh, gosh.
How long have you been married?
Advice number one, I got married in 2013, so just over 5 years.
All right. Give me, lay one on me. Lay one on me.
Yeah, my best piece of marriage advice.
I'm going to rate it.
All right. I stole this from someone else. It is peace before justice.
You stole that from Randy Newberg.
Yeah. I told you I stole it from someone.
Yeah.
But that's the best advice I ever got.
I stole my piece from Giannis.
What's that?
It's a good one.
My best piece of marital advice? Yeah. Okay. When you're fighting with the missus or the mister. Okay. Let's say you're in a fight. Let's say you're like, you're fighting over. Give me something people fight about.
How to load the dishwasher.
Who fights about that?
Steve.
Yeah. Well, not how to load it, but whether it should be loaded at all. There's a book about marriage. It's called Marriage. It's got a name. It's a polemic. It's about marriage. Is marriage worth it? And there's a line in the book where the author says, marriage is an institution that makes it so you cannot load the dishwasher in the way that makes the most sense to you. It's cynical, right?
Uh-huh.
However, okay, let's say you're fighting about the dishwasher.
Here's another example. The color of the paint that you're going to put in the newly remodeled bathroom.
Yeah. Fighting about the color of the paint in the bathroom. Because you've always pictured in your head that it's just going to like be white, right? Everybody paints their bathroom white.
And maybe it's not necessarily a fight, but it's like a heated discussion and it's getting towards being a fight just because someone might be tired. Someone else might be thinking about hunting.
Yep.
Are you feeling me?
You're feeling
you're
it.
You're not, like, so there you you're are. Not like fighting.
There you are. You're doing a remodel and it's time to get the paint. And you're kind of sitting there like, I think it should be white.
And in the name of managing your relationship.
Do you want to give the advice? You're the one who gave it to me.
No, I just want to co-host this.
He's played. So, he's the color commentator.
So you're like, it should be white, you know, because that's what I got in my head is white. And your partner is, oh, I was thinking it'd be blue. And then pretty soon you're like, you're in it. And you're fighting about it.
Yeah.
Giannis's thing is, you then need to say, you break the fight for a second. And you rate on a 1 to 10. Not how much you care to win, but you rate on 1 to 10 how much the issue actually matters to you.
And is this a verbal, like you say to each other, hey, time out.
Yep.
How much does this actually matter to you?
Yeah.
You say this to your wife.
Yeah.
And then you say how much matters to you.
You'd be like, you know, it's
or
a
you
three.
Just throw the number out before you even ask.
So you just say
you just go
four.
Three.
That's where me and my wife are at now. Really? We've been using this to great effect.
Wow.
And I don't need to say, I'll just say like, this is a 7 for me, man. And she's like, this is a 7 for you? This is like a 3 for me. That means you win.
Huh.
Damn, that's good.
I like that.
And you wind up, because I wind up being in these fights with my wife about things that once I stop and think about it, I'm fighting about things that are 2s and 3s. because you just get so wrapped up in like the, you get so wrapped up in just like winning battles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
And I have in the other day, like there's this rug that doesn't. All it does is like trip. Every kid that runs through the house gets laid up by this tripping on this rug. This like skitter across the floor and smash into the wall. And one day I like roll the rug up. My wife's like, "How under the rug?" I'm like, "I got the rug's gone." And she wants the rug back. And I'm like, "Dude, this is like a way." I'm going so far as to say this is the 7 or 8. This is a 7 or 8 on me. And she's like, "It's like a 1." I'm annoyed that you took my rug, but really when I think about it, I really don't. It's a 1. I don't know why I'm arguing with you, but if you hate the rug, you hate the rug. It's cool.
Wow. That seems like a life change.
Good marriage advice, man.
It's quite simple.
I like that a lot. Noted. It's going to get me another 5 more years of marriage.
Can I give you one more?
Please.
When there's like a large decision that needs to be made, and the decision is made of a big, great bundling of interests, say buying a house. I have found, my wife and I have found that it works really good if I say, here's the parts of this that I care about. I care about this element of this, and I care about this element of this. You run the project. Everything that I'm not mentioning right now is you, but do not screw me on these 2 things. And then you run and go. And assigning ownership of something and clarifying, like, but you own it, but here's the deal.
And this is an instance where the other person wants as much ownership as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you don't want to relinquish it because you don't want to get screwed on a couple points.
Right.
Clarify the points and then give the person autonomy to go do what they need to do.
Yeah.
It's a big, vacation, vacation, vacation. Be like, listen, man, I want to be able to spearfish. That's all.
The rest of it,
that's all.
Whatever.
That's all. I need to have like relatively good access to some spearfishing. Other than that, I'm out.
Google Walt Disney World / spearfishing. Yeah. Do the two come together?
That's good stuff.
Yeah. Guy, you've been married a long time.
23 years.
Give me a hot marriage advice.
Shut up. And listen, married to the best woman on the planet, and she's put up with a lot for me, but... I love her to death. I'm sure she'd trade me in, but I wouldn't trade her for nothing. And, yes, marriage is work. It's hard work. It's hard work, but when you truly work at it, you know, we have kids, but you know, we love our kids to death. But we've really grown to love each other, too. No. Women are awesome. Awesome.
You know, sorry. I don't mean to jump on the rest of your advice.
That's it. Shut up was it.
When, before my wife and I got married, she had, I can't remember, I guess it's a bridal shower or something like that. And everyone was asked to write down their best piece of advice, marriage advice or something, on a note. And you put the notes in the thing. And then after we got married, she got to open up the box and read everybody's marital advice. And I think I either saw some or she showed me some of them, and she showed me what her grandma had wrote to her. And at the time, what her grandma wrote was, it was very simple. It was just 2 words, 3 words. And I thought, oh, like that's just like the laziest answer. And that's all I thought of it. So that was just like a really lazy answer. And then my wife, though, took that little post-it note, and she put it on the picture of her grandma and grandpa. And it's still like in her bathroom, like sitting on the counter. And now years later, I see it, like every time I happen to be in there, I see it. And I think about it a little bit more each time. And now when I look at it and I think about it, I think about maybe what she meant by these 3 words, it's very poignant. And it's her very best marital advice was simply
love. Big giant box.
No, that would be good though. It was simply love each other.
Yeah.
Just love each other and all that goes into that. So I see that now like every day, and it's kind of like, yeah, if you're thinking about that with all the different decisions you make, that is kind of the key.
Like, just to remind yourself too.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, you know what I did? This is marriage advice. You know what I did when my kids were born, for all three of them, is I wrote them a big long letter that explains our lives, where I think they were conceived, what the circumstances, what our lives look like, what are my sort of apprehensions about them coming into the world, what are my hopes and fears for them, what's going on in general, what their parents were like. And then I put my own address on them. And then on the day they were born, I dropped them so they would get postmarked. And then I took them and vacuum sealed them in my Pro 2300, I think. Vacuum sealed them. And I'll give them to them when they get married, probably.
That's cool.
That's amazing.
That'll big, long letters. I almost would dread seeing what's in the letter from 8 years ago.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Do you regret anything that you wrote in these letters or worry?
I don't want to know, because I don't want to chicken out and not give it to them.
Yeah.
Because they're very telling. It'd be a lot better if I was dead. They're very telling.
Interesting.
Like, I would want, it would be smart to read it by yourself.
Where did you get this idea? This just came to you? Or?
No, I don't think I made it up, man. I can't remember, but I don't think I made it up. I feel like if I made it up, I'd be pretty proud of having made it up, and I'd remember making it up.
Yes, it's good.
I don't know why you'd ever chicken shit out about it.
Oh, I'm not gonna, man. I got a lot of
difference
effort.
Between you and you 8 years ago is so different.
No, because they're really like, they're really, really telling.
Of what? Of who you, and what, for you instance, were 8 years ago?
Yeah, just like stuff like around, we had two kids, and that was all we wanted at the time, and we had a third. And telling someone that story, I wouldn't tell him that story when he's eight. Like, what was going on in our lives, what led us to the decision, I don't know, just telling stuff.
I think your kids will be smart enough to read it in the voice of you as a late 30 or as the late 30 year old, and not the 60 year old you'll be when they read it.
Yeah, I hope so. It feels a good letter. They're pretty good letters.
I don't doubt it.
Put a lot of effort in writing them damn letters. Is that it?
That's it, man. Got one more guy. Thanks, man, for making a fantastic hunting spot, man. I got to see a lot of deer activity and what am I trying to say? Things that they do.
Behavior
that in all my years of whitetail hunting, I had never seen.
Yep.
All kinds of deer peeing on their tarsal glands and scrapes. Didn't see any rubs happening, but no. Yeah, I saw scrapes, no rubs. The licking branch thing multiple times. You guys heard a fight.
Yep. I got to see a buck come up and rub its orbital gland on the licking branch, work a scrape, piss down his leg. A couple minutes later, maybe more than a couple minutes later, another buck came, didn't do his orbital gland, but worked the scrape, pissed down his leg, and then I got to a couple minutes later watch a doe come and camp out on that spot.
Nice.
That's seeing some deer type shit going on, man.
Grunting. I bet you I heard at least grunt, a dozen, maybe 20 grunts this week.
Fighting, grunting,
chasing
squirrels, chasing every which way.
Normally, when you see, I don't care if it is November 10th in Michigan, when you see a deer running, you're like, ah, god damn it, no. But here, you're like, oh, it must be a buck coming, you know?
Yeah, it's chasing, running from other,
it's
bucks.
A good kind of running.
It's a good thing.
It's really cool. It's really cool, like the wildlife habitat work here and watching it like bloom and take shape, man.
And we're just getting started. And I mean, it's been a pleasure having y'all here. And I would like to know any and all things you guys think we might be able to do to make things a better experience.
Cut more shooting lanes.
That's right.
Yeah, that's, yeah, yeah. That's how you get it killed, but you're kind of focused on getting it alive.
Yeah.
don't worry. I'll be trimming lanes here soon.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.